Ladies and gentlemen, today is the first day of the rest of your life. And now, listen in as Kristen and Johnny bring it all to the table on the Vision Board Podcast.
Guys, welcome back. Episode 163 of the Vision Board Podcast. I'm Tristan Cannell, and alongside me, Johnny Stofko.
What's up, TK? What's up, everybody? 163, who we bringing to the table?
One of the favorite sons, Chris Algieri.
Yeah, back. Former world champion. How does Chris not have a nickname? You figure, like, in a sport like boxing, combat, he's a host, the guy's a nutritionist, and he's pretty. You would think he'd have a nickname.
We've known him for a while. We haven't asked him.
You know what?
I'll text him, and I'll ask him what his nickname is.
I was going to call him the Alchemist. Like, the dude is a scientist, you know what I'm saying? Like, alchemy causing, like, you know, a little bit of chaos with self-experimentation,
yeah,
sort of thing. Chris the Alchemist Algieri, I don't know.
He's setting a trend. Like, he's the smartest athlete I know, or maybe ever seen. Like, when you think about, his background is amazing with what he's done,
yeah,
with what he's achieved in sport. It's like, he's the perfect child.
Wow, man crush.
Yeah.
Yeah, dude. Guys, if you're not following Chris Algieri, just go to his Instagram. The dude stays in fight shape. He stays in combat shape. And it's almost like he's always getting ready to do a photo shoot. You know, that's, he inspires me in a sense of that. Like, being so professional, not only to his craft and his sport, but professional and holding himself up to a higher standard of not allowing himself to slip. Think about boxing. Think about the likes of Ricky Hatton or Prince Nassim Ahmed.
Ricky Fadden, let themselves go. But he practices what he preaches, and he's there year round. I love him.
Yeah, he puts in the work and the education side of things. Specifically, when we talk about educated athletes, the words education and boxing, really, you don't think of those two as being that sport. Mm. And then also this dichotomy of being a coach and still an athlete as well. So being able to wear both of those hats and still research, hosting. His suit game's on point. Chris Algieri's a man.
I think we both got man crushes on him.
Yeah, it's a shoulder game. You know, the separation from the bicep.
Is that why you grew your hair out?
No, he's growing his hair out to match my game, man. That swag is on. You know, this ain't on accident.
Competition going on.
Yeah, this ain't on accident. You know what I'm saying? This is premeditated. Have you seen our 40-year-old version?
Yeah.
Do you know that one scene when he's like, man, this is premeditated? Like all that?
That's one of the greatest movies of all
time.
That
whole bit, man. You know, Kevin Hart's in that.
He is.
Kevin Hart trivia. People sleep about it. He was an actor before stand-up.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right.
We'll digress
for the after show. But before we bring Chris on, just a big shout out to everyone subscribing to the show, leaving us 5-star reviews on iTunes, and, you know, just really tagging us on posts and just getting with us. It's awesome.
Yeah, guys, we appreciate you. We appreciate the love and support. Our last episode we released with Brian McKenzie, blowing off the charts because you guys are sharing it, liking it, tagging us. We really appreciate that feedback, and it just gives us further motivation and momentum to keep bringing it.
Absolutely. So get in touch, get involved, and we'll keep bringing some great guests like Chris Algieri,
the Alchemist,
Brian McKenzie. Yeah. The list goes
on. Dr. Jose Antonio.
Antonio.
Who we got coming up? You telling him, or are you going to save it?
Randy.
Oh, we'll talk about that later.
Yeah.
Yeah, let him wait for it. Guys, tune in, guys.
All right. Let's get to the episode with Chris Algieri.
Yes, sir.
Guys, our special guest is Chris Algieri. Chris is a former world champion boxer and kickboxer. Outside the ring, Chris has been doing some amazing work in wellness and nutrition. He's the performance nutrition coach at Stony Brook University, has a Master of Science in Clinical Nutrition from New York Institute of Technology, also a Bachelor of Science in Healthcare Services from Stony Brook University. He's a certified sports nutritionist by the ISSN, and he's also a fitness nutrition coach through the National Exercise and Sports Trainers Association. What a profile. A welcome back to the Vision World Podcast, Chris Algieri. Chris, welcome back.
Thanks,
man.
Guys. Always a pleasure to be on here. Appreciate you guys taking some time.
Yeah, Chris, man. Like, Tristan, that intro is impressive. And let's stick to the credentials and, you know, the education with the nutrition. I wanted to talk, you know, could you share some insights, Chris, when you're working with high-level fighters and you're still in your career as well, when you have to put your coaching and nutrition hat on, what's that like? Is there ever, like, you know, any sort of ego you have to deal with maneuvering through those waters, or do the athletes just take you on board?
You know, honestly, that's a great question. But I think honestly, with my background and where I've been, I think that takes the ego out of it. The fighters that I deal with, they know I've been there. They know that I know what they're going through. And the advice that I'm going to be giving them is going to be coming from a solid source who's been there, time-tested, and understands exactly what they're going through. So I think that actually helps to take the ego out of the equation when dealing with these athletes.
Yeah, where's the starting point? Like, for example, you know, you had a great camp with Daniel Jacobs just recently.
Yep.
In terms of someone at the high level of someone like Daniel, who's, you know, on the same level as yourself, you're both world champions, where do you start with someone like Dan?
So that whole situation was funny. You know, I've known Danny for years. We fought on the same cards in Brooklyn, you know, for much of our career. And when it kind of this fight came up, it was such a huge magnitude for Daniel's career that, you know, he wanted to see you out the best. And he had used nutritionists in the past, you know, and he had good success, but he kind of wanted something extra. And it just worked out career-wise that I was available. And him and I hit it off on our first time sitting down and kind of going through everything. You know, for me, like I got to gauge where this athlete's at in terms of, what their preparation is like. There are tons of guys out there that are just phenomenal talents, and they literally do everything else wrong. And they just show up and they're badasses. So dealing with guys like that's really difficult, but Danny's not one of those guys. You know, he's a consummate professional. So I got to sit down, talk to him, see how he kind of goes through things. And it was great to get an understanding of what his camp would look like. And then from there, tell him what I think I could do with his camp and how we can step it up to the next level.
Yeah, Chris, you just mentioned, you know, when, you know, doing things wrong, and Tristan and I were brainstorming on the evolution of boxing. You know, it's been around for over 100 years, where it's going. And in terms of, you know, the conditioning side of things, and you looking at it from an educated perspective as a coach, not the fighter itself, do you feel that there's any holes in, like, the preparation game of a modern-day boxer in terms of, like, getting ready for a fight? And if there is, could you share some insights on that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's absolutely some holes in terms of the training aspect of the professional boxer, especially from a conditioning and strength standpoint. You know, a lot of fight camps are very old school in their approach to how they look at strength and conditioning. You know, I think even more so than other sports, other combat sports, even like MMA, because the difference there is a lot of those athletes are former college athletes. They've been in a systematic, standardized training, strength conditioning program before. They've dealt with multiple coaches who had certificates and degrees and literally went to school for doing what they're doing. Most boxers, you know, guys don't go to college. They weren't in organized sports. They never had coaches that, you know, were spending their education learning how to do those things. You know, boxing is a lot more old school in that sense. And I think that there's a big gap in terms of where this sport can go with the right kinds of strength conditioning and weight management programs that are, I think, coming out in the very near future.
Chris, what's your take on things? Before we jumped on, me and Johnny were talking about, you know, the old school approach of doing road work at 5 o'clock in the morning. Is that something that you've totally eliminated?
Yeah. So we were talking kind of even before we even started about the endurance aspect. I run, and especially lengthy endurance work, way more between fights than I do during training camps. I don't think there's a lot of carryover for that over distance training during a 6, 8, or 10 week training camp. I do much more sprint work during that time. I'm in the pool. I've been adding more cycling into my boxing regimen, kind of protect those legs a little bit. That long, steady state endurance running doesn't have a lot of carryover for a boxing match. Boxing is extremely explosive. You got to have that base endurance, but you're going to have to be running sprints and really getting your heart rate up and being explosive and intense to mimic what's actually going on in a ring.
Yeah, we were chatting with Dr. Jose Antonio a few weeks back, and it was
man,
he has obviously nothing but amazing things to say about you, and your name kept getting brought up. But he said something really compelling that I wasn't aware of. I know you're a few years younger than Tristan and I. We're born in the early 80s. But Dr. Jose was talking about that up until 2001, I think that was the year he referenced, a guy or girl in America, they weren't able to go to university for sports nutrition. Like, at that time, you weren't able to educate and get a degree in that. And a guy like yourself, who not only is a high-level fighter, champion, and educated in that, what got you into wanting to, you know, get your education in the nutrition side of things? Was that to fill in holes in your game, or was that you being like a visionary, thinking like after your career would be over, you'd be able to like transition into that as a coach?
Oh, I'd love to say that I've had this all planned out since I was 15 years old, and I saw a huge gap in the sport.
You're visionary, you.
Could you imagine?
Yeah. That would be pretty awesome. Yeah. But no, honestly, it was selfish. You know, I first and foremost, I'm a fighter, you know, and a fighter, an athlete of any kind, really. You've got to be self-centered and try and see what serves you. So my interest in nutrition came from being injured during sport and going to see physicians, and they told me to take time off and to take, you know, drugs. So I was like, man, I mean, there's got to be a better way. So I've always been, I was always very good in school. So I've always had the kind of that scientific analytical mind. So I just kind of went on my own. And this is in the early 2000s, the internet was not quite as prolific as it is now. So I was taking a lot of books out of the library. I was reading a lot and kind of seeing where I could fill in the gaps with my own training. And then for me, my transition to boxing, I honestly was a super late start to boxing. I had to make up ground, especially in the beginning, by just being fitter than everybody. So I think that also was another service to me, really following up with nutrition and training, and sports science. And then, I really kind of fell in love with it and saw a need for it in my sport. And I do enjoy helping other people. So it just kind of fell into that.
Yeah. Chris, you just mentioned about, you know, getting into boxing and, you know, you kind of had to speed up your learning curve to compete on the high level. Could you share insights to our listeners at home about that exact perspective of a high level boxer? Because the fan and the average fan will see it as just a 2-point striking sport with the hands. But what is the difference? Like, what is the difference between a high level boxer and a guy that, you know, that we'll never hear of? Is it space? Is it distance? Is it timing? Is it tempo? Could you share some insights on that?
It's diligent work and discipline to the craft, because it is such a fine motor sport. It's hard to explain to someone who doesn't train in or know it. Like, hitting a bag is easy. Learning how to strike doesn't take a lot of time. Thinking you're good at it doesn't take a lot of time either. Yeah. But the thing about boxing is when you get in front of somebody who is better or is good or even better than you, you learn very, very fast that you don't know shit. And, you know, you get checked constantly in a boxing gym and throughout your learning curve in a boxing career. You know, once you get to that point of like, all right, well, I'm done working with a coach and hitting a bag, I'm going to spar. Man, you realize, man, there's levels to this shit. And there's no truer statement throughout the entire sport and the game. It is such a fine motor sport. Yeah, there's two weapons to work on. These guys have mastered these two weapons. They've mastered timing, space, distance, because that's what they have to work on. Yeah. And that's what they do diligently. There is no time in a boxing gym that is not mindful. You're going in there and you're working on very, very specific things that most people don't even know what they're looking at when they look at the different bags that are in the gym. This is time tested, hundreds of years old. This is a craft that has been absolutely mastered. And that's what you realize when you start to get deeper into the learning and peeling of the onion of boxing.
Yeah, Chris, can we talk a little bit about head trauma? Because when we had Dr. Antonio on, we had a great discussion about the usage of creatine. So for yourself, for someone that, you know, does compete in a deadly sport like boxing, and you've done it since a young age, so I'm sure that you've had things like concussions and things like that. So in terms of creatine, like insights, how do you use it and what have you found the benefits for yourself?
So it's a supplement that I've been using, creatine monohydrate, for we're looking at over 10 years for me as an athlete, using it I was using it as an ergogenic aid because it's so great for sprint repeats and as a muscle buffer, so you can go harder longer and be more explosive. But now there's been a tremendous amount of research coming out on neuroprotection, and it's helped with actually recovery from certain traumatic brain injuries. So it's just that even more of a reason to use it. And it's one of those things where I used to use it during training camp. Now I use it all year round. And I'm the kind of guy, a lot of times when I first came out, or they spoke about a lot in the beginning when I first came out, to kind of mega dose it early, you know, preload to a certain degree, and then kind of use it, after that. I'm not that type. I do use it year round. I don't kind of cycle through it. So I am a proponent of using a couple grams at a couple times a day. So 2 to 3 grams, 2 to 3 times a day. During training camp, I'll up that a little bit, especially early on. And, it's one of those things where I want to keep my muscles saturated with the creatine monohydrate. So it's ergogenic aid is always there. But at the same time, if there's anything going on neurologically, and it could be as little as, you know, just had a sparring session and got clipped with a good shot or got wrong or didn't even notice it. You're still getting hit in your head. You're still blocking shots and getting that, that cerebral spinal fluid to flush around a little bit. So, it's one of those things like, why not? You know, if it could have any potential benefit, then why wouldn't I do it when it comes to brain health?
Is that just in water, Chris, that you take it?
I'm sorry. Yeah. And I usually put it in my shakes. So okay. Like I'll have it in my morning smoothies. I'll have it in my post-workout shakes. If I have two workouts for the day, then I'm getting, you know, 2 or 3 doses of the creatine monohydrate each day.
Chris, do you think that, so I was reading about, you know, the advancements with like virtual reality in relation to sports and performance. And do you think that there will ever be a place in boxing in terms of the preparation? For one, do you think that you could get to the level you're at without the type of work that you put into the gym with the actual live human sparring? Do you think that it's possible to ever in the future achieve that without like having the sparring partner and taking the headshots?
That's an interesting point. I think we'd be so far off from that in order to make it, like I said, like boxing is such a fine motor sport.
Yeah.
And the degree and the room for error is so small. So I think it'd be really difficult from a programming standpoint to even make a program that was that fine. I don't know if we're there yet technologically, but in terms of being able to utilize that for training, maybe it's possible, but I don't know. I don't have a good answer on that. It's easy for me to say like, hell no, you got to get in there. You got to get in there and fight. But you never know. I mean, technology is amazing how far we can take things.
Have you seen or worked with any of those sort of bags that have the lasers on them or the noise, the ones with the sound sort of autonomous pattern to where they're trying to mimic like feints and slips and beats and tempos?
No, I haven't. I've done a little reading on it. And I've got a good friend of mine, Tony Ricci, who's way up on the technological advances, especially towards combat sports. And by the way, if anybody's interested in that guy, he's an incredible guy. Does tons of podcasts and a very interesting guy, strength coach, nutritionist. He's my nutrition mentor, actually.
Is that Tony Ricci?
That's Tony Ricci, yeah.
Okay.
He's another ISSN alumni. He's been with them for many years. He's the guy who brought me to the ISSN to meet Jose Antonio. So
awesome.
It's a little lineage there.
We appreciate that.
So in answer to your question is no, I've never actually worked on them myself. But I think it's definitely very interesting to get a different look on training and it'd be interesting to see how the crossover would be for like high level guys. Like how good would they actually be at it, or would it be like a tough transition?
Yeah.
Hey Chris, have you had any studies at all in terms of when someone weight cuts? So for example, if they lose 20 to 30 pounds, does that contribute to any brain trauma at all?
So good question. So this came up with the New York State Athletic Commission over here in the States a few years ago, where the commissioner wanted to enact a same-day weigh-in rule because they had some issues with guys gaining a lot of weight and then getting in and guys getting hurt. Namely, Arturo Gatti versus Joey Gamache I believe that was the early 2000s, which is one of the most brutal knockouts you'll ever see. I had heard that Gotti had put on somewhere in the vicinity of 20 to 25 pounds for the fight, and Joey Gamache, a former world champion, put on like 2 or 3.
Wow.
And they looked like they were multiple weight classes apart when they're in the ring. I was actually in the room for that night. It was at the Garden. And totally brutal knockout. It really raised a lot of questions about what the protocols are now for weight making, and should they make them the same day. The New York State Athletic Commission reached out to me because of, you know, my experience in the sport, but also because of my education and background in nutrition and hydration. And I spoke adamantly about it against having a same day weigh-in because of the same reason that you just brought up, Tristan, is that When you're depleting your body water and your blood volume, you are increasing the risk of brain injury for a number of reasons. One, your reaction times are going to be slower because you're dehydrated. Two, your cerebrospinal fluid is fluid. So if you're decreasing that much of your body fluid, there's going to be some residual effect throughout the entire body. So I propose that if you have guys that are cutting weight and then fighting the same day, they're still going to cut the same amount of weight. They're just not going to rehydrate.
Yeah.
And then they're going to go into the ring at a suboptimal hydration, which is just going to increase the risk for injury altogether.
So the, because there's that, you know, I was raised in Northeast Ohio, and in the early 80s, there was that famous fight with Mancini and Dooku Kim. And, you know, that thing was televised during the day. It was held outside in Vegas, like on a hot Saturday afternoon. And when that sort of, so you have like these extraneous variables in that fight. You have the weather, the climate, you have the obviously the amount of damage that each fighter took. But was the key component with what happened to Dooku Kim, was that the dehydration, in terms with all the head trauma of why, you know, it ended so tragically?
It's hard to say. Like you said, it's a multifactorial thing. It could be, the years of the head trauma adding up. It could be dehydration because of the heat. It could be, maybe his rehydration protocols were not that good, or maybe he wasn't ready for the climate there, the ambient temperature. Maybe it was because Ray Mancini is a monster, and the guy comes in and he throws a million punches and he hits you a lot and he goes back and forth, and it could have been just his time. But I do think that you can limit those risk factors by making sure that the athlete is properly hydrated going into the fight, cutting weight properly, preparing their body to cut the weight, leading for the weeks leading up to the actual weight cut, which is the week of. And then the rehydration, I think, is so important. I've seen guys who have had tremendous training camps ruin it in the last 5 days with their weight cut. So I think that there's definitely room there's a gap there that can be filled, and people could get better at this stuff. And I think that would limit the risk.
That's awesome insight, Chris. And looking at that fight, and guys listening at home, if you haven't watched that fight, it's on YouTube. You can see, but the thing about that's always intrigued me is that Dooku Kim, man, he had some, that was a really, really close fight. And if you read it on paper, what happened, without watching it, you would think it was one-sided. Now, that was back in the days of boxing 15 rounds. Now, referencing that fight in comparison to a guy like Lomachenko and what's happening in boxing and, that Walters fight, Walters being a champion and his corner throwing the towel in, and then that's almost like a repetitive pattern now. Every time Lomo fights, he does so much, work, and he's busy. The corner now is throwing the towel in. Could you talk about the evolution of the sport in a sense of that and the sort of mental – the mental effects it has on the fighter when something like that happens. And then just talk about the pros and cons of that with the sport itself of boxing, of like stopping fights early.
Okay. So couple different things to answer there. So Lomachenko, his style is exactly what we talked about earlier. Like he's gotten so good and mastering those angles and the timing and all these different things. And honestly, he's breaking guys' wills technically.
Yeah,
he's in their face. He's making them miss. There's nothing more frustrating than having a man stand in front of you, and you're a professional at punching people and things, and you can't hit them.
Yeah.
So he's got these guys, Nicholas Walters. That guy's a killer.
Yeah, man.
He's been in there, and he's starched guys.
Yep.
And that's what he does. He puts hands on people, he hurts them, and you got this guy who's standing right in front of you, and you can't touch him. You can't hurt him. That for a puncher is going to break his will down. Then he's hitting you every time you open up. Lomo's not a huge puncher, but it doesn't matter. You're getting clocked every time you do something. Every time you reach, you're leaving an opening. So you're breaking a man's will that way. And then what happens when you see those corners throwing the towels, it's not the corner. They're reading their fighter. They're seeing what's happening in the round. And then you're getting the feedback from the fighter himself when he's sitting in that stool. How you feeling, champ? And he gives you that, or he shakes his head no, or he blinks a couple times before he answers. That's telling nonverbal communication to their corner that this guy's not in a good place. I'll reference my fight with Ruslan Provodnikov when my eye was completely shut and the commission is coming in and asking me every round if I want to continue. If I had ever had any hesitation in my voice or said, I don't know, or excited or anything, they would stop that fight.
Wow.
Yeah.
I was giving them the communication that I was good to go. I'm winning the fight. Let me go out there again. If a fighter says anything other than that, if they say that they can't see or they have blurred vision or they don't feel good or this or that, that's just giving their team the chance for them to throw in that towel. And that's really what's happening. The corner's not quitting. You know, the corner's quitting for the fighter.
How tough is it to come back from that mentally as a fighter?
After it happened?
Yeah, pardon for me not knowing, but I don't know if it's happened to you in your career with either kickboxing or boxing, but say you have a guy, you know, like Walters, in combat sports, man, you know, people listening, the mindset approach to this, like, you know, you have guys who become champions because they outwill people mentally. So to have a guy sitting on the stool in the corner and then not coming out again, not because he took a big shot, but because, like you said, his highest tactic was neutralized. Talk about, like, from the fighter's mindset perspective, the next fight he goes into or his next camp, how difficult is that to come back?
I think that's a lot more a look at the times, like you said earlier, the era of the boxing that we're in. You know, we had guys, you know, early on in the 40s, the 50s, and 30s. These guys had losses all the time, and they were in with guys that they weren't ready for, and they lost, and then they came back and became some of the best champions we've ever seen. We've got a different shift now. We've got these built-up guys, these guys that are 20, 30, and 0, and who haven't fought anybody.
Yeah.
They've never really been challenged in there, or they were just challenged minimally. They got over them, and then they progressed to the next step, and then, you know, they go on from there. Then they got a title fight, and they're fighting an absolute world-class killer, and they fold. And we see this time and time again. You know, so you got to look past the records. You got to look at what these guys are fighting, what's happened in their career. So now, when you got a guy who's, you know, been undefeated for so many years, who probably hasn't been tested all that much, then he gets tested and he crumbles. How does he come back? It's really up to the guy. You know, it's up to that individual. Some guys come back and they have no issue at all, and they can go on with the rest of their career and go out there and kill it. I can't think of a guy who quit and then did that, but you know, you get outclassed at times. Canelo got outclassed by Floyd Mayweather.
Yeah.
Came back and he's been killing it and has looked phenomenal, hellacious ever since. You know, but ultimately he got outclassed in that fight. He lost 11 and a half rounds out of 12. That's a slam to your ego, especially when you're an undefeated guy. And look what he did with that. Mm-hmm. And then you got some guys who lose and then you never hear from them again. So I think it's a very individual thing.
Yeah. Chris, let's turn to weight cutting now. So let's use you as an example. So just say you signed a fight and you've got 12 weeks away. So just having a look how lean you are just naturally, I'm going to assume you're maybe 172. Would I be pretty close naturally?
165, I bet. What are you walking at?
Yeah. I'm more like 161.
Yeah. That's what I thought. Yeah.
Too muscly, brother.
Body composition.
I gave you 170.
Well, the shoulder game is on point, so you got to think about the separation from the bicep to the shoulder. We're both coaches, Chris, man. We're assessing people. And,
you guys know what's up. You know what's up. But, yeah, no, so I stay pretty lean and pretty light, a lot lighter than a lot of other guys out there.
Yeah, well, so
I'm also really active between fights.
But. 161, you fight at 147, so that's 14 pounds. That's pretty good. So we're looking at about 5.5 kilos, which is pretty good. So are you carrying that weight, like, literally, because 5 kilos isn't that hard to push water, is it? You could literally do that in the last couple of weeks, right?
Oh, you could do that in a couple of days.
Yeah. Would you do that? Like, how close do you get before you actually cut water?
Absolutely. So, yeah, so with a lot of these guys, and depending on the sport, so I work with a lot of MMA guys as well. And MMA guys can pull more water the week of. And a lot of them will cut a lot more weight. They're a lot more aggressive with it. Part of that is because a lot of them are former wrestlers and they know their body and they've done it before.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it is that it's a different sport. They're not standing for 12 rounds. You know, in 12 rounds is 36 minutes. That's a long fucking time. You know, so when you got an MMA fight, you know, there's groundwork. There's other places that you can kind of break the action and recover. There's also a lot more of the anaerobic portion of that sport in general. So these guys have a lot more muscle on their body. They're able to pull more water, right? So where does the water come from? It comes from your muscles. It comes from the muscle glycogen that's stored within the muscles that provides the energy for anything intense, right? So what you're doing is you're essentially pulling out the muscle glycogen, pulling out the water that's associated with the storage of that glycogen, and then you weigh in, and then you refeed and refuel and rehydrate.
Yeah.
So that's why you see these guys who are able to put on 10, 15, 20, sometimes 25 pounds between the weigh-in and the fight, because they're just restoring what was in those muscles anyway.
Chris,
it's really a manipulation.
How much sauna work do you do?
I don't do any during fight week.
Even with the cut?
I don't really believe in in passive weight reduction.
Yep.
The reason for that is, I don't know, I feel like it's taking water out of places that I can't necessarily put it back in the 30 hours that I have between, you know, the weigh-in and the fight. And at the same time, I'm in great shape. You know, I know that I'm in shape, and I know that doing a workout to sweat the extra pounds out, I'm going to be okay the next day. I've been doing this for 8-10 weeks now. I'm in great shape. Doing some low intensity cardio is not gonna sap me for fight night.
You were mentioning earlier, you know, your work with combat MMA fighters as well, and something that I'm really intrigued in, like just with performance and life in general, is momentum and being able to identify that momentum and use it as almost like a skill. And we see it in, you know, you see it in MMA, like all it takes is one strike and then the momentum can shift. And the question comes from, you know, like the killer instinct. Did you watch the John Jones DC fight?
I did, yes.
All right. So yep. Do you remember the fight before the Woodley Maya?
Yes. Yep.
All right.
Yep.
Awesome. So my question coming from a guy, because we asked the coach this question, and I'm interested in hearing from your perspective, being a world champ, is that in the Woodley Maya fight, Woodley had him hurt early, and he mm-hmm. there was a moment where I feel if you rewatch that fight, he could have pounced and finished it, and he didn't, and we know how that it went to the, you know, it went to the 25 minute mark, and it was kind of a boring fight. Mm-hmm. And then you have mm-hmm. the Jones DC fight. In my opinion, DC fought one of the best fights of his career. He got caught with that head kick, and you see John kind of take a step back in that split second moment and then attack and finish. Do you think that, with your experience, the Ruslan fight, pouring it on, having mm-hmm. flurries, do you think that you could teach that killer instinct as a skill and develop it, or do you think that you just have to have it?
So I think that you can teach the skill of how to follow up and when to follow up, but I don't think you can teach the eye to see it. Okay, so let me elaborate on that. So a lot of times when you're in a fight, I've been in fights many times, and I'm not known as a puncher, but I hurt guys, and I know that. And sometimes, especially early on in my career, and even my kickboxing days, like I didn't realize it a lot of times. I would come back to the corner, and my coach would be like, "What are you doing? You had him rocked." And I'm like, "What do you mean? I didn't really see it." And it's one of those things that kind of develops. You become much more aware of what's going on in there. So being able to understand that you cracked the guy, you hurt him, and you see it, and being able to capitalize is another thing. So I think you can teach a guy what to do when he realizes he's hurt, but he's got to be able to realize that on his own.
Yeah.
You can't teach him how to realize. That's something that has to develop within the fighter himself, and to be that much more aware and conscious of not only what's going on in between the ropes or the cage, but also to read your opponent's body language and eyes and face and breathing. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's awesome insight too. Okay.
Chris, do you think it depends on where you kind of grew up as well? Like, for example, I didn't get into any street fights, so Johnny always says, "Why don't you box?" Like, I don't have that killer instinct to finish someone off. That's why I don't box, because, you know, mm-hmm. I grew up in a really nice neighborhood, and I just don't I don't have that killer.
Yeah, and opposite.
Do you think that comes down to it as well?
I don't. I think it comes from your time in the gym, because, gym, sparring and boxing gyms, I don't know if any of you guys ever watched pros spar or sparred with pros. There's no love lost. It's not
yeah.
You're not moving around. You know, I tell people all the time, it's like, listen, you go to a gym by yourself in a boxing gym, you get knocked out, they'll drag you out the fucking back door. They don't care. You know? you better go in there with a coach. There's no love lost in a sparring session. And people ask me all the time, they say, "Hey, would you guys spar? Like, do you like really go at it?" I'm like, "Hell yeah, we do. We try to hurt each other. That's the name of the game." And you learn that from being in tough, heated sparring sessions. You know, there's all these legends of gym wars, the Philadelphia gym wars, the Kronk gym wars. And I think even now, like in the MMA space, we hear about the AKA, you know, these guys kill each other out there. Mm. You know, like you got some great finishers in that gym for that reason. You know, you got guys that are, even though they're spar mates, they're training mates, they're gym rats together, they're still trying to bust each other's ass. And that shows on fight night.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I wanted to touch base on the ethics of, you know, being a professional. We'll talk about the boxing. And so I was a big fan of, you know, when he was coming up as a younger dude. I liked Malignaggi. And the fight that comes up to mind when I was a younger dude was at the Garden. And it was Malignaggi versus Cotto. And at the time, did you watch? Man, and, you know, the energy of that fight of how, like, Paulie was just getting it handed to him. And then, you know, you saw momentum swing and the crowd was crazy. And the new MMA fan, the Ronda fans, the Conor fans, what's happening now with this chaos and this media circus with Floyd and Conor? And are you up to date with, like, that recent interview that Paulie gave about how he was dealt and the sort of, like, goings-on of how Conor's camp was treating him and that sort of thing?
I did. I know he left the camp, and I know that, you know, there were some words, you know, said afterwards, and I saw his post. Paulie's a buddy of mine, so I did see all that, but I don't know exactly what the most recent stuff is. Honestly, I've kind of checked out on this whole McGregor Mayweather thing as of recently.
From an ethical perspective, though, when you're like you've had world champion fight camps in the sport of boxing, do you feel that it should be dealt with? You know, even though you're preparing to want to hurt a guy, could you share insights on, like, the professionalism of, like, you know, camp to camp, the ethics of it? Are there, like, underlying things that the average fan really isn't aware of what's going on in terms of that preparation of the fight? Because it seems that you know, the Conor camp just wasn't aware of, like, the ethics of how to run a world champion fight camp.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. I'm sure they don't. I mean, like I said, I've done a number of you know, I've been in three world title fights, and I've trained for multiple high level fights, and I've brought sparring partners in. I've flown them from all over the world and brought them in. That I've had guys live with me. I've had guys where I was, you know, cooking their meals for them so I could get them in good shape so they'd be good sparring partners. You know, but at the same time, you kind of leave it at the door. Like, there's definitely an ethics to it. You're on the same team. You're working for the same you're working for the same goal essentially. But you know, you're getting paid. You're getting paid every day, every session. You're working. You're there to work. There is kind of a mindset and a team mentality, but at the end of the day, it's like you're brought in to do a job. You know, you're going to be treated properly so you can do the best of your ability, which is why you're here. But at the same time, you know, you've got to be able to treat those guys with respect and make sure that they're comfortable so they can do what they're brought in to do. And I think that may be somewhat of an issue. And, you know, I treat my sparring partners great. You know, when it's time to spar, I'm trying to kick their ass and knock their head off, but you know, they're trying to do the same thing to me. And if they're not, they got to go. If you're not trying to get after it, you know, then you don't need to be here. I can get somebody in here who will. You know, so it's tough. It's a weird thing. It's a hard thing to explain to people who haven't been in it or seen it. And I would imagine that the McGregor camp has not had that experience. So it makes sense that there would be some disconnect there.
Hmm. Johnny, have you got any more boxing questions before we go straight to Q&A style nutrition?
Yeah, I was going to go nutrition and start it off with
the
expertise.
What we're going to do now, Chris, we've got a number of nutrition, just straight out, you know, questions we're just going to ask and just get your feedback and your opinion on different little things, mate. Do you want to start with keto?
This bit about, you know, from a coaching perspective and being an expert in nutrition, talking to the general pop, so the average person listening to this, what's your insights on, you know, not just the ketogenic diet, but when people out there listening or wanting to lose, we'll talk about fat loss, you know, for instance, what's your advice to them to get started? Something very simple on someone who's struggling to lose fat and, you know, some applicable advice on that.
Okay. So regardless of keto, we're talking about just losing some body fat.
Yeah, we'll start there, and then TK will get into the ketogenic side of things.
Okay, so yeah, when it comes to body fat, I think what's always worked for me you know, when it comes time to kind of lean out, or when I've dealt with clients, with them trying to help them tend to lean out, is really just scheduling. Is really getting on an eating schedule, and it's based on physiology. It's based on your blood sugar and insulin. And our body works best. Homeostasis is the process that our body uses to kind of keep everything stable, right? We want to get everything in a very tight range. So if we think about that, like, our body spends a tremendous amount of energy trying to make sure everything is stable and everything stays in this tight range. If we think about our blood sugar and insulin balance like that, I've always found that that's the way our body works best in order to burn fat for fuel, to be efficient, to keep yourself energetic. So I always tell my clients, make sure that you start your day with a good hearty breakfast. And that could be, that's going to be a proper meal, meaning it contains protein, carbohydrates, and fats. And then to eat at regular intervals throughout the day. And scheduling becomes important, because if a daily life is just, you know, things can get crazy, and you can literally work all day and not eat, have a couple cups of coffee, and then you get home from work at 5 p.m. and you're starving. What are you going to do? You're going to overeat. But at the same time, at that point, your body hormonally is in a stage where it's ready to store body fat. So you haven't eaten all day, your blood sugar is super low, you're feeling sluggish, and you end up overeating, and you're going to crave those things that nature tells us we need, which are fats and sweets and salty things, salt, sodium. So I really think that maintaining a healthy dietary structure throughout the day and eating at regular intervals helps you stay on top of cravings, helps you to not overeat, but also keeps your metabolism high, so your body is utilizing fat for fuel throughout the day, and keeping you energetic as well as lean.
Okay, so your blood sugar levels and your hormonal levels, like you did just mention, say we don't eat anything all day and then just have 2,000 calories at night. Just say our body was meant to have 2,000 calories across the whole day versus just that one meal sitting at night. So there is a huge difference kind of when you should, yeah.
So I explain it as this, and from the kind of energy fuel continuum. So if I describe the metabolism as a campfire, right? So you got a campfire, right? You're camping, you're out in your tent, whatever. You got a fire, you got a load of wood. You take that load of wood and you throw it on the campfire at 10 p.m. What happens? You get this big raging fire. Mm. It lasts for a couple hours, and then by about 2-3 a.m. it's completely embers, and you're freezing until 5 a.m. when the sun comes up, right? Now, you take that same amount of wood and you portion it out throughout the night, and you're able to kind of slowly feed that fire. That fire stays burning, produces a lot more heat in the long run, keeps you warm, and is much more efficient that way. That's kind of how your metabolism works. You can eat a huge meal, you're going to get a ton of energy, but there's going to be that drop off. And that's essentially what's going on with your blood sugar. When you go, you're going to get that big spike, and then you're going to get that big drop. And that's going to affect your energy levels throughout the day.
And what's your insights on fasting? You know, coming from just the average person perspective, we're reading and hearing a lot about people incorporating like the 12-hour gap intermittent fasting. Could you share some insights on that and the benefits of that?
So I honestly have been very, very interested in really, I want to try it just for me to have kind of a better understanding about it, so I can talk to other people about it. I haven't had the chance to do that yet because I've been training and getting ready for some different competitions, and I don't think that there's a place for that when you're competing. Yeah. But for the everyday person, I honestly think that it can be really beneficial. It's shown tremendous, tremendous health benefits for people in certain disease populations or in certain maybe sedentary and active populations. Gut rest is a beautiful thing, letting your digestive tract kind of slow down and let that go. This is where things get kind of muddy for me, because I'm a performance nutrition coach, and generally I'm speaking to high-level athletes who are trying to kind of maximize their energy levels and their performance. But day-to-day, everyday, you know, normal population, it's completely different. You know, it's almost like two different species in terms of the population that you're talking about between athletes and regular people. So in terms of athletes, I don't really think it's a good route. But for the normal pop, I think there's a lot of merit to it, as long as it's done correctly.
Chris, what's more important, micronutrients or macronutrients, or is there no comparable?
They are very different. I think there's going to be and there will be a lot more interest in the micronutrient content of food and how that affects, performance in life and health in general. I have always pushed micronutrient content from on my athletes and the people that I've consulted with. I think that it's been overlooked for many years, but I think there's a lot more interest in it now. You guys see my posts. You know that I like colors. I like to post a ton of nutrition in everything that I eat.
Yep.
You know, I think that is ultimately super important in order to keep you healthy and functioning at a high level. So I think macros, just like anything, macros are big, micros are little. Macros, sometimes the bigger stuff is easier to deal with. Once you get a handle on that and then really focusing on your micros, making sure that you're getting enough in, I think is you got to be well-rounded.
And what's the first thing that comes to mind when you hear words like gut health, microbiome, gut flora?
So, first of all, huge fan right now. That's the first thing that comes to mind because everybody's talking about it. Mm. But that's nothing new in the nutrition world. The clinical nutrition world, that's nothing new at all. The immune system is located in the gut. Gut health, is incredibly important for every single system in your body. It's also related to your mind, your psychology. You know, the way that your mind works has a lot to do with, you know, what's related to your gut. You think about this in the most simplest terms. Hey, what happens when you're nervous? Get a stomach ache. You know, you feel uneasy, you feel queasy, you lose your appetite. You know, so that mind body connection is there, and really it's the mind gut connection. So I think when you're looking at it from a holistic approach and thinking about all of it together, that's really important. And if you have a healthy gut, you have a healthy immune system, and you have a lot of other systems as well. Your immune system helps with recovery from workouts. Your immune system helps keeping getting sick. Your immune system helps from recovering from being sick. So gut health is of optimal importance.
Chris, when can we eat bread? Because I know, you know, I follow you on Instagram and, you know, you put a lot of food out there. I love the burgers that you put up and all the stuff you do with eggs and things like that. You know, I know that you're obviously a performance athlete. So is that something that you eat on a daily basis? Is it kind of a rotation basis or only because it's a day that you've trained heavily?
For the most part, my diet is from what I post is that's pretty much what I do most days. You know, I always start with a smoothie, and those kinds of breakfasts that I post on my social media are pretty indicative of what I do day to day. You know, I switch up certain things, but at the most part, you know, I'm having a couple eggs or an egg white or omelet or whatnot. I'm having some carbs. I'm having like I said earlier, a proper meal in terms of carbohydrate, proteins, and fats. And then the rest of the day is which I post on my story now lately, because a lot of people are asking what I eat in between, you know, the big, beautiful breakfast and the big dinners. You know, there's a bunch of stuff in between that I don't think is necessarily Instagram worthy, but if people want to know what I'm doing at that time. And, you know, so I train most days, but even on my off days, I do like to keep my nutrition very high and very on point. And maybe the only thing that'll really change in terms of off day versus hard training day will be my carbohydrate intake. So I treat carbs as a performance fuel. So if I'm not being that active during a day, my carbs will go down. Mm-hmm. My total calories will probably go down because of I'm eating less carbs in general, and I do eat a lot of carbs regularly. But for the most part, I'll maintain kind of my protein and fat intake, even though my carbs are dropping a little. And then it'll pick back up the next day once I start training again.
Yeah, Chris, in America, they punish addicts, whether it's alcohol, whether it's drugs. If you get caught doing something with an addiction, you're sent to prison. And in relation to our relationship with food, you know, the general, the consensus, and then relating to obesity and diseases with our relationship with food, do you think, what's your stance on, the differences between an alcoholic, the addiction to an alcohol with the addiction, if we're just looking at what the addiction is to food and why it's looked at differently when people have an addiction to food, even though it's more of a visual and physical, addiction that you could see in relation to like the alcohol addiction. A lot of people can hide that. Do you think that our approach to that food addiction is in the right place?
I think a lot of it has to do with the food culture that we deal with. And it's not just this country. I'm talking about the U.S. anymore. It's kind of expanded globally in terms of what's out there. And there's a lot of low nutrient food out there. And I think that really affects the population, because the low nutrient stuff is cheaper and easier and much more available. But at the same time, you're not feeding yourself the way that they want to be fed. And you're getting, you know, you get people who are eating tons and tons and tons of calories and tons of non-nutritious food, but at the cellular level, they're still hungry, or they're still wanting. So I think it's really difficult for us to, go after these people that are probably food addicted when there's a systemic flaw that's, that there's a gap between the food that is being prepared and the food that's being served and what people are able to get. Also, you're looking at, we have restrictions on alcohol. We have, obviously laws against drugs. And it makes it much more difficult to get drugs. If they were already available, people might be more outwardly addicted, whereas food is available everywhere. You can get it at all times, all places, anywhere you can. It's never illegal to do. So, that addiction is much easier, like you said, to kind of, not necessarily mask, but just have available.
Chris, supplements, like obvious ones that people can fit into their diet, things like whey protein. We spoke about creatine before. In your educational sense, is there anything that you would tell the people in both performance and general pop to just avoid?
I'm a minimalist when it comes to supplements. I think there's definitely a need and a place for certain populations. Athletes, of course, I think their needs are so high because their output is so high. If I'm dealing with a female athlete and maybe she's 110 pounds and she's a long distance runner and she's putting in 60, 70 miles on the road a week, it's going to be very difficult for a 110 pound body to put in enough food to get all the nutrients that they may need in order to fuel their body for such a crazy output, right? So I think supplementation there becomes really important. How is she going to get enough protein in? It's going to be very difficult for her to get that amount of protein that she might need in order to feed her body, refuel, recover from her long distance runs, from her impact training, because running is impact. Protein needs will be increased by that at a regular meal without using any kind of supplementation. So for that kind of population, definitely supplementation is important, making sure they're getting all their micros, making sure they're getting enough protein in, making sure they're getting enough carbs in. It can be hard sometimes to just eat enough food. Day-to-day, regular people, certain things, fish oils, omega-3s, I think are really fantastic. I think having a multivitamin, multimineral supplement for, a blanket to make sure you're not missing anything is important, because like I said earlier, the nutrient content of the food is not where it should be. And people might not have a varied diet anyway. So making sure you're getting those, filling in those gaps, I think is important. But I get asked, about some specific supplements, like, should I take aminos? I'm like, no, you train 5 days a week, 5 times a week. I don't think you need an amino acid supplement. You don't need to fill in those extra gaps the way that an athlete who trains 2 or 3 times a day, who's actually working really hard, is, and you're not. So I think people fall in love with using supplements when they probably just need to work harder in the gym and eat real food.
Chris, I cook quite often, something I really enjoy doing. So let's talk about cooking with oils. Recently, I'm really getting into macadamia oil, the benefits. Nice. Yeah, the benefits of it. It's fairly new to me. And the more I learn about the benefits of macadamia oil, the more I'm learning about the negative effects, at least written, when you cook and heat olive oil. And, being an Italian background, and that's what I was raised on, is there merit to the negative effects when they talk about heating olive oil and it changing fat properties? And if so, what oils do you recommend cooking with?
Yeah, you're breaking up.
Yeah, so to sum up the question, just stick to cooking with oils and talk about the pros and cons of which ones you use and what oils that you wouldn't use.
Okay, so when it comes to cooking, it all comes down to the saturation of the oil itself. This has to do with chemistry, and in terms of the bonding of the oil, of the molecules itself. We need to get really too much into that. But so when it comes to high heat cooking, like frying or anything like that, saturated fats are going to be much more stable. Okay, so a saturated fat is one that's stable at room temperature. It's usually going to be a solid, like butters or coconut oil, things like that. And then extra virgin olive oil, which you never see hardened unless you refrigerate it or freeze it, is going to be an unsaturated fat source. So at high heat, that oil is going to start to smoke a little bit, and it's going to release some smoke, and you're going to see that. So when you're cooking with olive oil, that wouldn't be the best thing to fry with, because it's a high heat form of cooking, you're going to get that early smoke point, and that's going to be not healthy. It's going to change the chemistry of the oil. It's not going to affect the same way in your body. So that's where it's better. Like, I fry my eggs in butter. I love butter. I eat butter every day of my life. And I think that there is a place for it in your diet, whether you're trying to lose weight or not. But also coconut oil works really well as well. Mm-hmm. It's got a higher smoke point. You were mentioning macadamia nut oil, another great healthy oil that you can use for cooking. So when it comes to that, it really comes down to the saturation of the oil itself. Whether it's saturated or unsaturated, that's kind of the stability of its chemical structure.
Yeah, let's stick on fats there, Chris. When you've done a workout, mm-hmm. do you avoid eating fats in the meal straight after?
Okay, great question. So when it comes to a meal after, you're in what's called the anabolic window,
yeah.
right? We've heard that before.
Yep.
So that's usually everyone always talks about that first 30 to 40 minutes after post-workout. And that's where you really want to focus on carbohydrates, protein, and hydration. Our body is ultimately primed to take the carbohydrates that you've used during that workout and store them in the muscle as glycogen, which you mentioned earlier. Also depends on the kind of workout you did. If you did 20 minutes on the elliptical, you're probably not going to have to refill your glycogen stores immediately. But if you did a 50-minute, you know, high-intensity interval session and some weight training, your glycogen stores are probably pretty depleted. Your body is going to be primed then to kind of take whatever the carbs you eat and put them back into the muscle. Then this is actually when you want some fast digesting carbs. It's going to hit your bloodstream immediately. It's going to be pulled into your muscle. Time is of the essence. That's why that anabolic window is a thing, right? So that's where our body is most primed to use whatever nutrition we take in to kind of recover from the workout that we just performed. So studies have shown that utilizing carbohydrates with protein and a ratio from anywhere from 1:1 to 4:1, depending on the type of activity you've done, can really help to refuel those glycogen stores and get you ready and recovered for the next workout. Also, it also reenacts your immune system. High-intensity training really, really decreases your immune system, and it kind of makes it kind of go dormant. So once you introduce some carbohydrate and some protein back into your body, it kind of reignites that immune system. Once the immune system is back working, your body's ability to recover from the damages causing during micro tears in your muscles and whatnot can start that healing and recovery process immediately. For the athlete who's training twice a day, 6 days a week, that becomes ultimately very, very, very important. For the guy who's training three times a week, not so important. But so that nutrient timing becomes really important. So right after you work out, carbs, protein, hydration. The reason we want to limit fats there is because fat in a food that you eat will limit or will actually make you the gastric emptying time, the time it takes for those nutrients to leave your stomach, longer. And because time is of the essence in terms of pulling it out of your blood, your stomach into your bloodstream and into your muscle, fat wants to be limited during that first meal.
Chris, in regards to performance and sport, in every sport we see guys getting popped. Doing, whether it's PEDs, this, that, or the other thing. If it were legal in your sport, would you do it?
No, never. Absolutely not.
And do you think that it would create an even playing field? And is it even in a question of, like, in your sport, boxing, if some guys are and some guys aren't? Because I know some sports, there's a big gray area. And, to solve that gray area question, do you think making it legal all around the board would be a good idea?
No, absolutely not. Not in this sport. I am adamant against PEDs in this sport. This is not a foot race. This is not a swim. This is not a cycling. This is man against man. This is punch versus punch. This is brain cell versus knuckle. There is absolutely no room for drugs in combat sports. There's contact. There's it's a hurt business. You're trying to hurt somebody. You got to do that with what nature gave you. If you're fucking cheating, you're a fucking cheater. And I get revved up whenever this kind of stuff gets brought up, because I think there's absolutely no room for it in combat sports. Again, it's a foot race. Yeah, okay, cool. Baseball, yeah, nobody's getting hurt. Nobody's hitting each other. Let everybody do it. It will have awesome home run derbies. That's cool. But boxing, MMA, kickboxing, there's absolutely no room for not only everybody to be on it, but one guy and not another guy. I mean, that's assault. You're going in there with a weapon. You're going in there with something extra. I'm really adamant about this. I have 100% against any kind of PEDs for combat sports.
Yeah, but even the other sports, Chris, as well, because the thing I don't like about it is the fact that I don't think people understand the side effects. So between the ages of 20 and 30, they're on top of the world because they've got so much testosterone going through them and they're performing at such a high level that, you know, they're the king of the world. But once they get off it, that age between 30 and 60 is the most miserable time of their life. And it's kind of like a short-term gain for a long-term pain without them understanding the actual, you know, repercussions of what's going to happen later in life. And like you did mention,
Most athletes don't care. They're so focused on what their career is and what they can do and how much money they can make in that time. You know, they don't think about the repercussions, like you said. You know, they're focused on what they have in front of them right now. It's a very small window.
There was this. Just last night, I was reading about that tragedy in New York State with the high school football player, the 11th grader. They were doing a strength. They were doing a strength and conditioning exercise, carrying a log over their head. And the young man, it hit his head and he passed away. Things like that in terms of educating people and practices of, you know, younger people who aren't professionals with coaching, wanting them to perform at a high level. What's your opinion on like the pushing mentally of these young men who aren't quite adults yet, the threshold of pushing them too far?
You know, there's ways to do it. You know, I thoroughly believe in pushing these young guys, pushing them past their limit, make them be on the brink of failure, make them fail, push them too hard. You know, that's great, but like they shouldn't get hurt. You shouldn't put them in an environment. That's up to the coach to make sure that they're in an environment that is safe. That is first and foremost. You cannot hurt these kids. You can't hurt any of your clients. You know what I'm talking about. Yeah. You have to be sure that everything in the environment is safe. You're in control of what they're doing. So, like I said, I'm all about pushing a client, but you gotta use your head about it. You gotta make sure that it's safe and worth the risk versus reward. What's the reward of that workout? We push these kids. They're exhausted. They're tired. They feel like they really push themselves. Okay. You can't do that with hill sprints. Why you gotta make them carry a 700 pound log on their back? You know, there's the team aspect of it. Okay. Have them do a team, you know, like pulling a rope or something or whatever. Like, why put them in a dangerous situation? And anytime you put them in a dangerous situation, why have them compete? I heard they were having this sprint with this weight on their back.
Yeah,
that's just it doesn't make sense to me.
Chris, final question before we let you go. In terms of resources that you use, you know, I know you're exposed to a lot of the stuff that the ISSN do, and it's brilliant work with reports and things like that. Aside from that, and also your professional experience, is there any websites, podcasts that you turn to continually upskill?
I love your podcast. You guys are pretty awesome. You guys are really great guests. I like a couple of the podcasts. I like Barbell Shrugged. I was just on Mind Pump Media recently.
They're very,
you know, those
good
guys are great, and they really do their due diligence, and they get great guests and they ask great questions. I've listened to a bunch of their other guests, and you definitely walk away learning some stuff, and I think that's really what this is all about. I have a pretty wide breadth of interactions with really, really smart people, like you said, like guys like Jose Antonio, guys like Tony Ricci, my buddy Dr. Corey Peacock.
Corey,
I think you guys spoke to. Yeah, that's my boy.
Yeah.
You know, so we have a lot of people kind of put our heads together, but in terms of what's actually out there right now, listen to the podcast and I've sent such a great resource in terms of getting real scientific data, because that's really what matters.
All right, before we let Chris go, get following Chris, www.chrisalgeri.com. He's on Facebook, official Chris Algeri. Instagram, he's Chris_Algeri. I highly recommend you get on that one. And also Twitter, he's Chris Algeri.
Yeah, Chris, man. Yeah. Thanks again. This was awesome, man. Keep up the great work. Keep inspiring people, man. And we appreciate you sharing the space, man.
Absolutely, guys. Thank you so much. Appreciate you sharing some time with me. It's some really good stuff. Hope to hear from you soon. Yeah.
Right, Johnny, we had a great chat with our boy, Chris Algieri.
That was awesome, man. Like, how many things did we cover? How much time could we have spent with that guy, you know?
Yeah, it's... He brings up some interesting points. Like, it's a very educational sort of thing, and I hope people can... I think the best thing about what Chris said, people can start applying things, and they know the ins and the outs of, like, when and what his opinion is. He's very educated. I love it when someone that is as well-credentialed.
Yeah, and then how much does their opinion mean when they are well-credentialed, right?
Absolutely. So,
yeah, it definitely has a different effect and a different energy about it, getting insights and opinions from the educated perspective, but then champion perspective.
That's what I love. The fact that, you know, how many fat nutritionists do you know?
Yeah. Yeah, right? That is actually the analogy they use. Like, how many...
No, I'm being serious.
Oh, no, in America, they'll use that analogy. Like, how many, you know, overweight nutritionists do you know? And the answer is a lot. But how many 6 percenters, world champions, do you know? One.
That's what I love.
And what's his name?
Tried and tested.
Yeah.
That's what I really
That's what
love.
Alchemy is. That's why his nickname, Chris the Alchemist Algieri. I'm going to tweet it. But you talked about he was bringing up some good points, and there were a few different times in that interview when we would ask the question, and the way he would frame it, we would look at each other like, wow, I never thought of that. And I have to look back at my notes one specific time, but I don't know if it was when we were talking about PEDs or if you were asking the question about the road work or the ethics of the sport. But he was giving us really, really inside kind of like insights into the goings on of a high level performance athlete,
yeah,
which he really doesn't get to come across when he's doing a 30-second clip for HBO.
Yeah, but I think that's what also people have to put in perspective too. It's that you can't just copy what a professional athlete does. That's why I like Chris, because he puts it in perspective for a general pop person as well, because the way he trains, the way he eats
is him.
It's a great starting point for people to see what a healthy lifestyle looks like for a professional athlete. But then you've got to kind of see, like Chris did mention, on days where he doesn't train, he cuts back the carbs and he has different ways that he has to eat. And that's different things that people have to put in too. You can't just eat like Chris Algieri and expect results. That might mean that you have the same meals as him, but it might be in different portions, different quantities of different foods. For example, you might eat a little bit more protein. You just got to figure that out, do a little bit of research, or even better, get some professional advice.
I thought it was really compelling about his stance on addiction when he didn't really sell me on it until the very end when he talked about I'm going to have to re-listen to it about the, you know, the being an alcoholic or a drug addict, about it just being right in front of you with the food. It's just being thrown at you. I think, you know, I'd like to read some studies. If anyone's done any research on this, man, send me an email. But what I'm pretty sure from a behavioral standpoint and from what the addiction actually is, because addiction doesn't choose whether it's like, oh, this person's addicted to drugs and this person's addicted to alcohol and this person's addicted to sex and this person's addicted to food. The addiction is the addiction itself. The way it manifests person to person will change, but the addiction itself, the behavioral pattern, is the same. So it's pretty fascinating that we demonize certain addictions and then certain other ones we kind of just sweep under the carpet. It's just normal.
It is a fascinating area, like, behavior and changing behaviors.
Yeah.
It just seems like it's the hardest thing in the world.
This is going to come across really, you know, I'm coming from a good place when I say this, guys, and if anyone's offended, I apologize, but I think to curb we have to be reactive about the obesity problem and all the diseases that come along with it, specifically in Australia, in America, because the stats are ridiculous, the percentage of people who are dying young because of the food that they're putting into their body. When are we going to get to the point where it becomes a crime to self-sabotage yourself? And then when you have children involved and you have kids and you look at these families who are like repeating the same cycle of behavior of this, the father's obese and then the child's obese, that I heard an expert once say that that's child abuse. What's your opinion?
I think it all starts, that's where it all starts.
And where?
It starts at the government level. The American and Australian government, the ticks of approval they put on certain products and certain things, like that food chart shit that they bring out every year, I'm not sure who writes it.
Dude, definitely not an athlete. Definitely not a performance-based coach.
Anyone that has actually studied any form of nutrition or been exposed to any high level of nutrition can ever agree with some of the shit that they put into that food pyramid thing. And then you've got in America, there's food cereals all over the place that have been given ticks of approval for people to say it's healthy. It's like, where do we start? Because they're the people meant to be controlling our countries and authorizing what's good and bad. Some people just don't have access to nutritionists, and they just believe. Well, the majority of people don't have access.
The majority of people.
Probably thinking 80%.
That's a stat that you and I don't have right now, but you're right. And it's huge. It's a huge number. And, you know, being proactive now rather than reactive from a general pop perspective, it comes down to education. It comes down to educating yourself and understanding that these people – let's talk about food, the FDA, Food and Drug Administration. There's no way that those two words should even be in the same sentence, food and drug, let alone the same business, because that's what the FDA is. And do these people really love you and do they care about you when they're throwing cereals down your throat and sporting events sponsored by alcohol companies and things like that? So I think it comes down to a nuclear family level, home to home, educating yourself so you can educate your family. And then maybe that's how we turn this around.
You brought up gut health in there, right? So for example, how many GPs will you go to? You've got a sniffly nose and they'll prescribe you antibiotics.
Oh my God.
As the first line. That should be your last line of defense.
I'm glad you brought that up, man. I mean, how guys listening, if you guys are prescribed or given antibiotics by your doctor, you need to say no.
If you're dying in your sickbed, then yes, take him.
Attaboy. But if you have an ear infection, like I had an ear infection, exactly. I went swimming.
If you got a sniffly nose or an ear infection, you probably...
I didn't take it. I said no, and then the ear infection healed itself. But people, there's Australia right now is having a tough time with resistance antibiotics. Like the masses now are reacting differently to once... would react in a certain way.
Do you think it's because it's an easy way for a doctor to churn and burn so many people
for
in
sure.
a day, and because they don't know the other side of it, how to actually eat themselves properly and how to kind of the natural side of things with vitamins and different little practices that you can do, even if it's just something simple like a meditation or a sauna or things like that, that can combine to actually make you feel better away from these antibiotics.
And guys, any doctors listening, I apologize, but Western doctors do not heal. Western doctors do not fix anything. They are problem solvers. So they assess you, and there's a skeleton system in terms of a matrix. So they have their factors, they tick their boxes, and then, oh, you fall into that category, take this. When's the last time a doctor healed or cured anything? We need to cure and heal ourselves and understand how the body works naturally, like you said. The Eastern medicine philosophies have been around for thousands of years. That's where Western medicine came from. And all of a sudden, we're at this day and age where when we hear to do acupuncture for a variety of health benefits, we're like, oh, that's wishy-washy. Or we hear meditation for silencing our mind. Oh, that's wishy-washy guru. How did we get there? Because that, up until maybe 100 years ago, was the commonplace of how we would heal ourselves. And I feel we've lost a huge connection to that, how to help ourselves, because we're so quick to go out of our own body and have somebody help us. And I think that has different frequencies too in our careers, in our families, in our relationships. And it's just chaos, man. And once again, I think it all starts out at home. We need to educate ourselves.
Yeah, cool. I think we'll leave it at that because it's a great point. And it's a great take-home point for people at home. It's
something we're both passionate about, man.
Very educational, man, and I think people should just re-listen to that last couple of minutes because I'll back you up on that one. I totally agree with that one as well. I think the Western world has made it – I don't even have to say anymore, man. I think it's done.
It's just difficult for us to know which direction to go, though, right?
Like, yeah, think but about hopefully it. Through things like podcasts and even just – you know, just properly educating people. Hopefully everyone can do their little bit in their area of expertise. And hopefully we can all together.
Yeah, man. Too many people are dying young. And our bit, you know, is what we're doing here. And, you know, listening to this, if you do have questions with nutrition, go to Dr. Rhonda Patrick's page. If you really are into learning and upskilling, she is a high level researcher.
Yeah. And again, disclaimer, we're not saying don't take antibiotics. It's just educate yourself a little bit first. If you're dying in your sickbed, you might need them. So we're not saying don't take them. Just in the process, when you get prescribed them, just think there might be some alternatives you can do before you take that last resort. That's what I would like people to kind of get out of that.
And that's an amazing point, because you initially brought it up, is the gut health. When you're researching the antibiotics and when you tell your GP that you don't want them, you would have already learned about how long it takes your microbiome to replenish itself, your gut flora, your immune system in your stomach. Some say over a year.
Yeah.
After two of those pills, those Z-Packs, it takes a year, studies have shown, to get your homeostasis in your immune and your gut health back to what it was before that.
Yeah. So challenge your doctor, I reckon. You're like, don't just cop out on an antibiotic. And
yeah, question.
Yeah, question, and talk to your family and friends, see what their advice is, and do some research yourself and satisfy yourself, I reckon.
There you go.
All right, Johnny, next week on the show, we've got Randy Couture.
Yeah, man. I'm super excited, man. This guy, we've been trying to bring him on for a while. I actually used to serve the guy. He's a Vegas boy. He has Extreme Couture there. I used to live in Vegas. And he's going to add another element to our show in terms of his repertoire, what he's doing, his education. Most people, they hear of a combat world champion, they don't think of a poet. They don't think of an eloquent vernacular, like speaker sort of guy. And you know firsthand.
Yeah, so that should be an exciting episode. Before we leave, Johnny, social media.
Guys, follow me, Johnny Stofko. I'm really going hard on my Facebook. Anybody listening who already follows me, I apologize for killing your feed.
All right, guys, I'm Tristan Cannell, Tristan Cannell Fitness across all mine. Hit us up if you want to chat with both of us, info@divisionboardpodcast.com. Please send through any feedback you've got on the show, and we'd love to hear from you. It's either going to be myself or Johnny answer you back, so please get in touch.
We are a two-man band. We appreciate you guys.
All right, guys, we'll check you next week.
Peace.
Peace.
Welcome to the Vision Board Podcast, stories of success from around the world.
You guys are scratching an itch, and that's why this podcast has become popular and successful, is because you guys are scratching an itch. You're enjoying it, and you're also benefiting from the knowledge that people are dropping.
I've never met the person in my life, including my parents, that was able to outwill me about me.
Whatever profession you're in, you need to keep working hard at it. You know, nothing comes easy these days, and you know, you'll get knocked down, but get back up, that counts, so just keep working hard at it.
You know, you guys said you do stuff, you ask things that aren't Googleable. You guys are two for two.
There's never been a time in my life where anybody ever was able to tell me who I was more than I knew who I was.
To join our vision and follow the journey, please subscribe to the Vision Board Podcast via iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher.